From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of a controversial heart drug and what it reveals about the process of testing, approving, and marketing new drugs. We talk with Thomas J. Moore, author of the new book Deadly Medicine. The book focuses on a drug prescribed to treat irregular heartbeats, which actually caused cardiac arrest in many patients. Moore criticizes the FDA for overlooking the dangers of the drug. We'll also speak with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. Temple approved the controversial heart drug. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is ordering an investigation into possible U.S. government involvement in the deaths of two men in Guatemala. There are allegations the men were killed by a Guatemalan military officer who was a paid informant of the CIA. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has told the House International Relations Committee that both he and President Clinton are not certain of the facts. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
The allegations get more serious every day, allegations that the White House says President Clinton is very concerned about. The investigation will now look into a letter sent to Congressman Robert Torricelli on National Security Agency stationery, alleging that efforts are being made to destroy records showing U.S. Army intelligence and officials of the NSA's knowledge of the murders. The Washington Post quoted a senior Justice Department official as saying, "All necessary steps have been taken to ensure the security of the premises at the NSA's headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland." The New York Times also reports in today's editions that the CIA continued to secretly send millions of dollars to Guatemala's military government, even after President Bush ordered military aid cut off in 1990. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Investigators say yesterday's fire in New York's historic Fulton Fish Market was started by an arsonist. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
New York City Fire Commissioner Howard Safer says the four-alarm fire that ravaged part of the turn-of-the-century structure was intentionally set. He says an arson dog detected the presence of a flammable liquid on the third floor of the building and that fire marshals found burn patterns indicating that an accelerant had been poured down a 40-foot hallway. Safer also notes that the building's sprinkler system failed and was apparently tampered with. The Fulton Fish Market is the target of a recently announced crackdown on organized crime. For decades, the mob has allegedly controlled business there. There are no suspects yet in the fire, though the fire department says there are a number of leads. The U.S. Attorney's Office has asked the FBI to determine whether a federal investigation is warranted. The Fulton Market is the country's largest wholesale fish center, doing about $1 billion of business each year. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter has entered the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Specter made his announcement in Washington with the Lincoln Memorial as his backdrop. He says he'll champion core party values, including small government and lower taxes. He also says he'll fight for basic freedoms, including a woman's right to have an abortion if she chooses. The Senate has confirmed former Congressman Dan Glickman is the new Agriculture Secretary. He succeeds Mike Espy, who's resigned to fight ethics charges. The vote to confirm Glickman was 94-0. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 14 points to 4,174. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Officials from the Federal Communications Commission have lowered access fees that long-distance companies must pay for access to local phone systems. FCC Chairman Reed Hunt says they've taken $1 billion out of the nation's phone bill. He says competition will force long-distance firms to pass their savings along to customers. Hunt says people should start seeing savings this summer. A federal judge in Philadelphia has found the National Voter Registration Act constitutional and has ordered Pennsylvania officials to comply with it. Robbie Harris of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
Pennsylvania and a handful of other states have refused to comply with the act known as the Motor Voter Law. State officials here argued that the states, not the federal government, has the power to regulate voting and that implementing such a law would be too costly. After the National Voter Registration Act took effect on January 1st, several community groups brought suit against Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge and other state officials in an effort to force them to comply and allow voters to register when they apply for a driver's license or welfare. U.S. District Judge Ronald Buckwalter said today that they must, but he has not said exactly how that should be done. A hearing defining how the law should be implemented is scheduled for Monday in federal court. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
Almost all kinds of mass transit in Japan are on high alert. The Japanese Prime Minister has ordered tighter security for government officials. These alerts come after Japan's top law enforcement officer was shot in the back today. He's been leading the investigation into last week's nerve gassing of the Tokyo subway system. Police are looking for a masked man who fled on a bike after shooting four bullets into the officer's back. He's hospitalized in serious condition. Several Japanese news organizations say they've gotten calls blaming the shooting on the religious sect. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A drug that was hoped to prevent cardiac arrest actually ended up causing it in many heart patients, possibly as many as tens of thousands. My guest, Thomas J. Moore, has written a new book about the story, which he describes as America's worst drug disaster. His book, Deadly Medicine, raises larger questions about how we test, approve, and market prescription drugs. The drug Moore writes about was developed to treat irregular heartbeats, a condition known as arrhythmia. The chemical name of the drug is flecainide acetate. Moore follows how the 3M company developed and marketed it under the brand name Tambacor. The drug is still prescribed for people with life-threatening arrhythmias, but for several years, the drug was more widely prescribed. Moore says this was in spite of evidence showing how dangerous the drug could be. In the second half of our show, we'll speak with Dr. Robert Temple, the FDA's Director of Drug Evaluation. Thomas J. Moore is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. I asked him what the antiarrhythmic drug was designed to do.
This was a family of drugs whose principal use was to suppress very mild premature heartbeats, often so mild that only a cardiologist could spot them on an EKG. The patient didn't even know them. They had a theory. The theory was if you suppress these mild premature beats, it might prevent very lethal electrical breakdown of the heart that kills people. Unfortunately, the theory was wrong.
What was wrong?
When, after hundreds of thousands of patients were taking these drugs, they were finally tested to see if they had health benefits for the patients, it was discovered this whole family of drugs did not prevent death. It caused cardiac arrest in about 6% of the heart patients who took the drugs, a truly shocking death toll.
What are the names of the drugs that fall in this family?
The names of the drugs include Tambacor, Rithmol, Tonocard, Procaine Amide, Mixitil, and a variety of drugs with the generic name Quinidine, and they have names like Quinolan, Quinaglute, Cardioquin, and Quinidex.
What should patients who take these drugs do? Are doctors still recommending that patients keep taking them?
There's an important warning for everyone who takes heart medication. It is dangerous often to stop any form of heart medication, including the drugs I've been talking about, without consulting your physician. This is not a do-it-yourself project. However, if you are taking an antiarrhythmic drug for a condition that's not life-threatening, and we now know that there are thousands and thousands of people doing this, you might well want to get a second opinion from a cardiologist.
Does the FDA recommend the use of this drug only for people with life-threatening conditions?
The FDA says that these should not be used for non-life-threatening disturbances. There are slight differences in the label for each drug, but that's the thrust of this. This drug is today approved for only heart rhythm disturbances that are so severe and persistent that the patient's life is actually endangered.
Now, your study of these heart drugs lead to larger issues within the pharmaceutical industry and the medical testing area. So I'd like to get to some of those larger issues. Why don't we start with testing? How were these antiarrhythmic drugs originally tested?
Interestingly, they were tested at some length. The feature drug in the book called Tambacor was tested for 12 years. But there was a large gap in the testing, large enough to drive a truck through. The 3M company was not required to prove, believe it or not, that the drug benefited patients. They were only required to prove that it changed their electrocardiograms. So as a consequence, we didn't have the key piece of information. So often it's not how much or how long, it's asking the right question. And almost always the right question is, do drugs benefit the patient directly, and are we sure of it?
Well, how did such an important test end up not asking the question, does it help the patient?
Truthfully, it was too expensive to answer that question, and the government didn't make them do it. You can prove that you can change an electrocardiogram with a relative handful of patients observed perhaps only a few weeks or a few months' time. If you want to prove that a group of patients has a lower risk of death, that sudden death will be prevented, you would literally have to study many hundreds of patients over many years' time. And the drug companies didn't want to pay that money if they could sell these drugs without that testing.
Now, did that original set of tests show any dangerous side effects?
One of the most important things I thought went wrong as I researched these drugs was that even in early testing, people tended to drop dead with an unusual form of cardiac arrest soon after starting therapy with these drugs. And one of the most puzzling threads of this drama in deadly medicine is, why did the experts in the field who often saw these cardiac arrests with their own eyes disregard this evidence and let them drugs be prescribed for thousands and thousands of patients?
What do you think?
I believe they were too close to the drug industry. They were too wedded to a theory that it was beneficial. They disregarded study after study that failed to prove the benefits, but they were very close to the drug companies. Their career depended on drug promotion and drug development, and they literally failed to see what was right in front of their eyes.
There was a more recent test of arrhythmic drugs done in 1989, sponsored, I believe, by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Yes, and this is what you might call drug testing after the fact. After almost a million people took drugs for irregular heartbeats, the National Institutes of Health sponsored a very expensive $40 million randomized clinical trial to find out whether they had benefits for patients. After only about a year of testing, they came up with a shocking answer. Not only were there no benefits, patients were dying in shockingly large numbers.
And I believe the test was discontinued when they realized how many people were dying.
So many patients died that they had to halt the test to protect the patients in the trial. Practically all the cardiac arrests that they were recording in the patient population occurred among those patients who were taking the active drug, not the patients who were taking a harmless placebo.
Now, the first studies that were done on these heart drugs, they were organized by the drug companies?
Clinical studies are organized, conducted, and paid for by the pharmaceutical companies, typically, in order to obtain the approval of the FDA. But they're actually conducted, usually, in medical school research centers.
You said that these drugs were not proven to prevent cardiac arrest?
Yes.
Yet the drugs are still being prescribed for people who have life-threatening irregular heartbeats.
Well, this is true, but at least among those with a life-threatening irregular heartbeat, the drug has a demonstrable effect. That is to say, a person has a heart who has a kind of electrical short circuit, and it's beating so rapidly that their health and life is compromised. Sometimes these drugs can stop that life-threatening irregular heartbeat. Now, these drugs may also have great risk of killing the patients, and I wish we were more confident and had better data to make sure that the benefits of these drugs outweighed the risks. But at least in this group of patients, we have real benefits that a physician can see. In the other patients, they had mild irregular heartbeats and that the patients couldn't even detect it. They were taking a drug that was all risk of dying, no benefit.
Thomas J. Moore is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Deadly Medicine. He's a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. Let's bring the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, into the picture. The first of these drugs for treating irregular heartbeats was approved by the FDA in 1985. The FDA saw the results, obviously, of the initial round of tests. What was behind the FDA's decision to approve the drug?
This was one of the most dramatic moments in the book. The senior physicians at the FDA sensed the dangers of Tambacor and drugs like it. They had observed that there were these mysterious cardiac arrests, and they proposed to restrict the whole family of drugs, including drugs already on the market. But in really one of the most pivotal points in this book, they get talked out of it under pressure from the pharmaceutical industry, because the money was to be made from treating mild irregular heartbeats. That's where about 7/10 of all the patients were. And the drug companies wanted the money, and so they pressed and persuaded the FDA to relent, and as a consequence, the drugs were approved without the severe restrictions that might have saved thousands of lives if they had stuck to their guns.
What was the restriction the FDA first considered putting on the drug?
They proposed that it be limited only to life-threatening ventricular arrhythmias, which is the limitation on it today, and additionally, that the drug be started during hospitalization, which would have made it very difficult and very expensive to begin this drug, and only a select group of patients with truly life-threatening conditions would have ever taken the drug, instead of millions of people with irregular heartbeats so mild that they couldn't even tell they had them.
If the FDA saw that the drug was killing some of the people taking it in the studies, why did the FDA approve it?
That is one of the most moving chapters in the book, because the senior doctor who had the final say literally lists the deaths on a piece of paper one by one. There was someone who had dropped dead while gambling, another person who had died at a picnic, another person who had suddenly dropped dead playing tennis. He could not be sure in which case the drug was responsible or the patient's heart condition, but he was worried about the evidence. Nevertheless, he was persuaded there were patients with very serious rhythm disturbances who would be helped, and so he moved forward to approve the drug, but with severe restrictions.
But then those severe restrictions were eased up.
And he got talked out of it by the pharmaceutical industry, by the expert consultants to the FDA who also worked for the drug companies. They said, no, this drug isn't as dangerous as you think. And of course, when a drug is not properly tested, you can't quite tell just how dangerous it is.
I think you imply that medical experts who worked on FDA panels were compromised by their relationships with drug companies.
I go much more than imply it. I state and document that several senior experts upon whom the FDA relied for advice about the safety of these drugs were allowed to perform this function at the same time they were receiving many thousands of dollars from the drug industry to test these drugs, to promote them, to do other sorts of work on them and write about them, usually favorably in medical journals. I believe that the lethal properties of these drugs would have been spotted much sooner and understood much more quickly if the FDA had not relied on medical experts with very close ties to the drug industry, with open admitted conflicts of interest we would not tolerate in any other type of governmental activity.
The FDA put tighter restrictions on the use of these drugs after the 1989 National Institutes of Health study was released, the study that showed the dangers of the drug.
Yes, but the response of the physician community, Terry, has been terribly disappointing. Just last week at the American College of Cardiology, a new paper showed that 1/3 of physicians continued to prescribe this family of drugs for patients with mild irregular heartbeats, the exact group that the FDA now warns against. There was another survey that showed 81% of the cardiologists surveyed were not taking their patients off these drugs if they had earlier prescribed them. And so widespread inappropriate use of these drugs continues. But if you go to the FDA and ask them, why aren't you doing something about this, they shrug their shoulders and say, we can't tell doctors how to practice medicine.
Why do you think there remains inappropriate use, inappropriate prescriptions of these drugs?
I believe that physicians either don't want to call their patients in and admit they made a terrible mistake and prescribed their patient a drug that had no benefit and might have helped kill them. And I believe that's a very hard thing for physicians to face honestly with their own conscience, and an even harder thing for them to admit to their patients. And so an awful lot of physicians just hesitated to take their patients off the drugs. Second thing, obviously some physicians didn't get the word because not every drug was covered in this NIH trial. They just decided to assume, well, maybe the other drug, because it was not implicated, directly included in the trial, maybe the other drug was safe. But we have no evidence that drug was safe. The FDA says it's prudent to assume every drug in this family contains similar risks.
There's a movement now to deregulate the FDA. Newt Gingrich called David Kessler, the head of the FDA, a thug and a bully. Gingrich called the FDA the country's number one killer and criticized it for discouraging innovation and not approving drugs quickly enough. And he would like to design a replacement for the FDA. You're a critic of how the FDA handled these drugs to treat irregular heart rhythms. Would you like to see the FDA dismantled?
I would go completely in the opposite direction and believe that the evidence is that the FDA is not strong or independent enough to ensure that our drugs are adequately tested today. The Republican proposed changes would simply loose more untested drugs that might kill thousands of more people onto the market and would be a disastrous mistake.
You say you don't think the FDA is independent enough. What are the forces that you think are acting on the FDA that might compromise it?
The AIDS community, pharmaceutical companies, patient groups put incessant pressure on the FDA to let them have drugs that are not very well tested. There's almost nobody out there. I can't tell you how lonely it feels to be one of the very few voices out there saying, we need safe drugs so they don't kill people. There are just a few people like me. There is a vast army, often supported with huge amounts of money from the pharmaceutical industry, pressing for lower standards and less testing. Sometimes people are just medical optimists and they would rather have hope than evidence of benefit. Sometimes it's drug companies that know they can make more money on drugs that don't have to undergo so much expensive testing.
My guest is Thomas J. Moore, author of the new book Deadly Medicine, a study of the testing, approval, and marketing of a controversial heart drug. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thomas Moore is my guest, and he's the author of the new book, Deadly Medicine, and he's also a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Health Policy Research. Another issue I want to look at that relates to the study that you did in your book, and this has to do with pharmaceutical company profits and marketing. Now, you say in your book that the amount of money spent on drug research in the pharmaceutical industry is smaller than the amount of money the drug company spent on actually marketing the drugs to doctors, advertising the drugs to doctors.
To me, the largest scandal that I came across, if you will, is all we hear that drug companies need to be twice as profitable as other companies because of their expensive research and development. I learned that one quarter of the prescription dollar goes for high-pressure marketing for gimmicks and trinkets for doctors, for 10 billion free samples a year, for symposiums at luxury resorts where you can adjourn from a little one-sided presentation to go skiing if you're a doctor. The patient does not see the suffocating embrace that the pharmaceutical industry holds the medical profession.
You mentioned free samples within there. I've surely gotten my share of free samples from doctors over the years, and it saved me money.
I believe that this is one of the tools that the drug industry uses to manipulate doctors to get them to try new drugs. I believe that the doctor should be relying on well-fashioned clinical trial information, not a trinket or a sample to decide what's best for the patient. They would not give away so many drugs if they knew it didn't influence doctors, and they are not using facts, they're using gimmicks and gifts. And maybe you like not to pay for one set of drugs, but wouldn't you rather pay a little for a drug that you knew worked?
But I assume when a doctor gives me a free sample that the doctor has some faith in the sample that he's giving me.
I assume that too, but that's how they sort of hook doctors on particular drugs. That's how drugs that are not very thoroughly tested often replace drugs that are better tested through free samples and patients like them. Maybe they have a few less side effects, but they are not proven to have the results. And when this system goes wrong, the results are disastrous, with literally thousands of people dying.
Are there other reforms within the medical profession or the pharmaceutical industry or within the FDA that you recommend after having done the research for your book, Deadly Medicine?
There are three really important things we need to do. We have to cut out the conflicts of interest. The same doctors who work for the drug companies and promote drugs should not be allowed to help the FDA judge their safety. That, to me, is an intolerable conflict of interest. Secondly, we need to sever this cozy relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the nation's doctors. It's time to put trinkets and gifts and luxury resort symposia behind us and start evaluating and prescribing drugs based on the hardcore testing results. Thirdly, we have to test our drugs better. Every drug, we need to know that it benefits patients, not that it makes some little change in the electrocardiogram or blood pressure goes up or down or some laboratory measurement changes. We need to know that the patient gets better, feels better, or lives longer. Those are the hard bedrock standards by which you decide a drug is safe and effective. And every time we get away from it, we may pay a terrible price.
What kind of research do you do before taking a drug that you're prescribed?
I don't happen to be taking any prescription drugs right now, but I recommend that everyone should read that what's called the package insert or label, which your pharmacist will give you. You may have to puzzle through it, or get one of the volumes in the library that describes the medical uses and the side effects of drugs. It's very important, especially for any long-term drug that you take over a long term, to know what its properties and side effects are. If you have any questions, or maybe also ask your doctor specifically, what are the risks of these drugs? What benefits can I expect? What are the most likely side effects I should look for? These are the kinds of questions you need to ask about every drug you take.
I want to get back to the FDA. Given that we're in the middle of a move to deregulate the FDA or do away with it, how would you like to redesign the FDA if you had a chance to do that?
The FDA needs a little more of everything. It needs more money. It needs more staff. It needs not the worst world's worst working quarters in the world. It also needs the ability to either order, pay for, or conduct drug studies that the drug companies can't or won't do. Part of the reason that needed studies are done is the drug companies think they're too expensive, and there's no money to pay for the studies. Also, the FDA needs to do a better job monitoring the adverse reactions of drugs. We have a hit-or-miss system that depends on a doctor who just thinks he might have seen an adverse reaction. We need to systematically study the adverse reactions of new drugs after they're introduced. These are the most important changes.
Well, who should pay for expensive drug studies?
The answer I have is the consumer pays in the end, no matter who conducts it. We could do it either through regulation, through acquiring more studies, which would raise the price of drugs. We could do it through establishing an institute like the National Institutes of Health that was capable of doing drug studies that perhaps the companies couldn't reasonably be required to do it. We could do it by subsidizing the drug companies for certain kinds of... There are a lot of tools to get the studies done. I don't think that's as important as realizing that we aren't doing the right studies now to be sure that the drugs we have are directly benefiting patients, not affecting some laboratory measurement.
Thomas J. Moore is the author of the new book, Deadly Medicine. He's a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. In the second part of our show, we'll hear from Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our discussion about the controversial heart drug that's the subject of Thomas J. Moore's book Deadly Medicine. The drug, prescribed to treat irregular heartbeats, actually led to cardiac arrest in many patients. But the FDA official who approved the drug says when properly prescribed, the drug's benefits outweigh the risks. We'll talk with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation, about the procedure of testing and evaluating new drugs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter has officially entered the race for the Republican presidential nomination. He staked out a position as the only Republican in the race to support the right to abortion. He made his official announcement in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington today, where he criticized the Clinton administration's foreign policy, as well as religious conservatives who are trying to dictate the conscience of the individual.
Let me say it as plainly as I can. Neither this nation nor this party can afford a Republican candidate so captive to the demands of the intolerant right that we end up by reelecting a president of the incompetent left.
Specter is the fifth Republican to officially announce his presidential candidacy. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says the term limits legislation will be back. The measure was defeated in the House last night. Supporters are trying to keep the issue in the public's eye. Several lobbying groups are unveiling a plan to put a term limits advisory referendum on all 50 state ballots next year. They want to seek voter views on term limits, the balanced budget amendment, and other issues. Speaker Gingrich is blaming the defeat of term limits on Democrats, but several prominent Republicans have also opposed it. Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Hyde says term limits are nothing but the dumbing down of democracy. The attempted assassination of the chief of Japan's National Police Agency has stepped up security in Tokyo and deepened public concern, already heightened by the subway nerve gas attack, for safety. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Japan's chief of police underwent 6 hours of surgery for multiple gunshot wounds after an assailant shot him as he stepped from his apartment house to his waiting car. Shortly after the attack, an anonymous caller told Tokyo television stations that more of Japan's top police officials were next unless police stopped their investigation of the group Aum Shinrikyo. The raids on the sect have turned up stunning quantities of potentially poisonous chemicals. Police will not say whether the shooting of the police chief was related to the investigation of the group. Aum has denied any involvement in the attempted killing that has deepened a sense of dread in a country unaccustomed to gun violence, let alone assaults on its central authorities. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
House Republicans have defeated an effort to block U.S. aid to Mexico. Republicans who oppose the $20 billion line of credit to Mexico say the GOP House caucus has rejected a move to bring the issue to a floor vote. They say President Clinton overstepped his authority when he used an executive order to approve the financial aid to Mexico. But both House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole had approved the arrangement. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow gained nearly 12 points to close at a record high, 41.72. This is NPR. A federal judge has ruled against the Clinton administration's policy on homosexuals in the military. The judge says the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is discriminatory and violates free speech rights. The suit was brought by 6 homosexual members of the armed services. They challenged the policy, which calls for gays and lesbians to be honorably discharged if they discuss their sexuality. The 39-page ruling says the policy is deceptive and offers powerful inducements to homosexuals to lie. Lawyers on both sides of the case expect it to be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. After weeks of turmoil on currency markets, the German central bank has announced cuts in interest rates, taking financial markets by surprise. The Bundesbank reduced its discount rate by 0.5% to 4%. Carolyn Wyatt reports from Berlin.
The Bundesbank's surprise decision to lower its rates has been warmly welcomed here, both by German businesses and the government. Although the Bundesbank released a lengthy statement stressing that the cuts were made in response to domestic factors, such as the reduced threat from inflation, many financial experts believe it simply couldn't ignore the sharp rise in the German mark for any longer. With the economy here heavily dependent on exports, companies have been warning that the strength of the German currency was starting to damage their sales abroad. Economists had even begun revising their growth forecast for this year downwards as a result. But this rate cut has now made the German mark less attractive to foreign investors, leading to an immediate rise in the values of other European currencies as well as the US dollar. That will ease some of the pressure on German exporters, whose main trading partners include other European Union countries and the USA.
Carolyn Wyatt reporting for the BBC. President Clinton says spending cuts he's proposing are better than anything the Republicans are offering. He addressed a joint session of the Florida legislature today. He touted his crime bill and praised Florida for its welfare changes, saying the state system works and does more than the federal changes passed by the House. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, health policy researcher Thomas Moore told us the story of how a drug designed to treat people with irregular heartbeats, or arrhythmias, actually led to cardiac arrest in many patients. Moore criticized the FDA for overlooking the dangers of the drug when it was first approved in 1985. 4 years later, a study by the National Institutes of Health led the FDA to place more restrictions on the drug's use. Moore says this story raises larger questions about how drugs are tested, approved, and marketed. We called Dr. Robert Temple, the director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. He made the final decision to approve the drug Moore wrote about. The chemical name is fecinide acetate. It's marketed under several different brand names. I asked Dr. Temple to respond to Thomas Moore's criticisms of how the FDA approved the arrhythmia drugs.
Well, his analysis is complicated. Let me give my bottom line. We believe that we approved the drug for two claims that were adequately supported by the data at the time, and that there was nothing unusual or odd about it. I should say what the two claims were, because that's important. First, we approved the drug for use in people with life-threatening abnormal rhythms of the heart. There's really no controversy about whether that should have been done. Everybody agrees with that. We also approved it for certain people with symptoms associated with their abnormal rhythms, even though those people were not at immediate risk of death. We approved it in people who were so symptomatic that their physicians and they thought that the benefits of using the drug outweighed the risks of the drug, and those risks were clearly described in labeling and included the possibility of dying. So we approved a narrow section, a narrow claim in symptomatic patients. We never, under any circumstances, suggested in labeling, and the company didn't either, that the drug should be used in people who had abnormal rhythms that could be seen on electrocardiogram, but that were not either symptomatic or life-threatening.
So what confuses me here is, why would you want to approve a drug for people who are at great risk, knowing that the drug might only increase the risk of death?
Well, you didn't know that the drug would increase the risk of death. What you knew is that some people got worse, but of course many people got better. The difficulty is that when people have immediately life-threatening arrhythmias, that is, these are arrhythmias that will kill them today, you have to make them go away. You can't keep shocking a person or defibrillating a person over and over and over again. You have to do something. And it's regrettable but true that all of the drugs that you use to try to do that make some people worse. That's one of the reasons you start people like that on a drug in the hospital, in the hope that you can tell whether the drug makes them worse, and therefore then you wouldn't use that drug. You'd try to find another one. So it wasn't that the drugs, on the average, make everybody worse, then of course you wouldn't use it, but that one possible adverse consequence of using the drug was making it worse. Now remember, it was only approved for people whose symptoms were so bothersome that it was worth taking a drug that had these risks associated with it. The physician and patient needed to make that decision. But if they did make that decision, we thought the evidence was good enough to allow the use in those people, those carefully selected people. You know, you have to know people with these conditions, but abnormal heart rhythms, even if they don't threaten to kill you, can be totally immobilizing. People can sit all day concentrating on the turmoil that's going on in their chest and just be immobilized. So there are some people in which there is a great gain from treating symptoms. I need to emphasize again, the labeling and we never recommended use of the drug in people who didn't have serious symptoms solely for the purpose of making unsymptomatic rhythm abnormalities go away. That was not that physicians didn't do that. Sometimes they did. I'll return to that. But that was not recommended, and the labeling actually discouraged that use.
I think the key change that the FDA made in its thinking on the antiarrhythmic drugs was that first the FDA wanted to restrict use of these drugs to patients with life-threatening conditions who were in the hospital, under a doctor's care in the hospital, so that the side effects could be monitored very carefully. But then the FDA changed its opinion on that and let the drugs be used also for people with serious symptoms associated with irregular heartbeats, and let the drugs be prescribed for patients who weren't in the hospital. What exactly changed your thinking on that?
The company presented a lot of new data and the results of additional studies that we interpreted as showing that the risks in people without these life-threatening arrhythmias were very small. We couldn't say they were zero, but were very small, and that therefore the drug could be used in selected patients like that, and that it was not necessary to hospitalize them. They addressed the very question that we raised.
One of the morals of this story, as told by Thomas Moore in his book Deadly Medicine, is that the FDA backed down on its initial judgment to restrict the drug to patients with life-threatening illnesses who would receive the medication while under hospital care. And he says the FDA backed down because of pressure from the pharmaceutical company. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm very conscious of the pressure word because people have used it. I think it depends on what you mean by pressure. What the company did in response to our initial letter is send me a half-inch thick document in which they reported on new cases and did new analyses. They didn't call my boss. They didn't call a congressman. They didn't call many people in the scientific community to tell me I was wrong. All they did was respond. Now, you know, if that's pressure, I'm not sure that's, I don't think that's what most people would mean by pressure. People have more nasty things in mind. I think the company did nothing but sustain its argument in the ordinary scientific way. The implication that something sinister happened just isn't correct.
My guest is Dr. Robert Temple. He directs the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. His office is criticized in a new book called Deadly Medicine about a controversial heart drug prescribed for irregular heartbeats. Is there ever a problem, in your estimation, of conflict of interest where doctors on FDA panels are also paid consultants to pharmaceutical companies?
Well, that is certainly an issue, and I'll tell you how we try to handle it. First of all, the judgments of these panels are advisory to us, and we, the people who have to make the final decision, are scrupulously avoid anything that could resemble a conflict of interest. We can't own shares in anything remotely related to what we regulate. Our advisors frequently are people who have carried out studies of drugs. And it's hard to argue that that's undesirable. I mean, you would want, we want the best people in the field, and one would hope that drug companies would ask the best people in the field to carry out their studies. That, in some sense, is how it ought to work. We have rigorous conflict of interest requirements. You can't serve on a panel that's reviewing work you did that was critical to the approval. If a scientist has studies ongoing with a company at the moment, he can't participate in the vote. In some cases, the person can speak but not vote. We have a variety of things like that. And the basic principle is you avoid overt conflicts of interest, and if things are at the margin, you announce to everybody assembled at the meeting, essentially all of which are public, what those conflicts might be. What Moore is talking about is mostly people who were paid for doing clinical studies by drug companies. Obviously, opinions on this sort of thing can vary, but that's not the same as working for the company, being a consultant to the company, or walking around the country giving speeches about the company's drug. Those are kinds of things that make a person something like an employee, and we would be very leery of those relationships. But doing a study for the company, not necessarily on this drug, is something that we do not consider to exclude a person. So I don't think that the people who do trials are captured in the way that Moore does. This committee, for example, the Cardiorenal Committee, in 1984 was advising us strongly to limit the labeling claims for antiarrhythmic drugs. They were concerned about the use of these drugs in people who didn't have any symptoms at all in order to try to prevent death. And they said, correctly, there's no evidence that these will prevent death. Any hint in the labeling that the drugs should be used for people who don't have symptoms is bad practice. We don't think the labeling should recommend that. And they were busily advising us to correct some old labeling that didn't make that distinction clearly. So their behavior was not very supportive of drug companies' interests, which would be to expand, presumably would be to expand the use of the drug as widely as possible. So these very people who are charged by Moore with having gotten their priorities confused were advising us in very strong terms to limit the claims for these kinds of drugs. And in those and in private conversations, they don't act like they're slavishly loyal to drug companies. So I think one has to be conscious of the potential for conflict of interest, obviously, but I don't think these people had that problem. And we think we manage this properly.
Thomas Moore's book, Deadly Medicine, is subtitled, Why Tens of Thousands of Heart Patients Died in America's Worst Drug Disaster. Do you think that's an accurate description of what happened, or is that hyperbole to you?
Well, it's hyperbole. Let me say what we know. There is one thing we know. We know from the Heart and Lung Institute's study that patients who'd had a recent heart attack and who were treated with these drugs to clean up their electrocardiogram in an attempt to save their lives, but nonetheless, that's what was being done to them, almost surely died more frequently than they should have. The only population we know about is that population, people with a recent heart attack with extra abnormal beats. What Moore does is apply the same mortality increase that occurred in that study to everybody who got any antiarrhythmic drug in the country. And there is no basis that I can see for making that extrapolation. That's where he gets the kinds of numbers he does. I have no doubt that there were deaths in patients with heart attacks who got those drugs in an attempt to save their lives because the drugs didn't save lives. They took lives. And it's a considerable, that was a very unfortunate outcome. And there's no question, many, many people died. The exaggeration of this by applying, as I said, the same figure to everybody who got the drug, I cannot see how that makes any sense.
My guest is Dr. Robert Temple. He directs the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on today's court ruling on gays in the military?
Hi, Terry. There's a ruling in New York today, a federal court ruling about the Clinton administration's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which has been in effect for 2 years now. The judge says the rule violates free speech rights in this country. Also tonight, Robert Siegel talks with a reporter in Istanbul about Turkey's offensive against the Kurds. Joe Palka tells us about a 5-year-old boy born HIV positive, now testing negative. Mara Liasson is traveling with President Clinton in Florida, talking with lawmakers there about boosting the economy. And we'll have an interview with Denise Graves, singing Carmen in her hometown of Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Dr. Robert Temple, director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. His office is criticized in a new book called Deadly Medicine about a controversial heart drug prescribed for irregular heartbeats. We heard from the author of that book, Thomas J. Moore, earlier in today's show. Let's look at one of the larger questions about the testing process. What Thomas Moore says in his book Deadly Medicine is that studies of new drugs don't necessarily analyze the drug's benefit to the patient. Sometimes they just analyze laboratory data. If the laboratory data will be changed, for instance, will a drug give you a better-looking cardiogram? That's what the test will look at, as opposed to will this drug help you prevent a heart attack? Will it increase the length of your life? Is this a problem in testing?
It's a very important question. And it applies not just to antiarrhythmic drugs, but it applies to many kinds of drugs. And we talk about three different kinds of endpoints of a study, that is, things you're trying to show. The most gratifying thing to show is that a drug improves survival. Another gratifying thing to show, an important thing to show, is that it improves a troublesome symptom. That's a perfectly legitimate reason to use a drug. For some things, for some kinds of drugs, it has been considered sufficient to show that an important measurement that is thought to relate to death is improved. For example, long before it was proved that lowering cholesterol was good for you, drugs were approved to lower cholesterol. The labeling said it hasn't been proved that these drugs improve your survival. But there was a lot known about cholesterol. It was well known epidemiologically that high cholesterols were associated with increased mortality and extra heart attacks and so on. And we long ago made the decision that we didn't feel no drug should be approved before the unequivocal demonstration that lowering cholesterol with a drug would improve survival. There was huge amounts of data showing an association of death with high cholesterol. And although we asked people to carry out those studies after marketing, we didn't wait for approval to approve those drugs. Now, the data are coming in on cholesterol lowering, and they are certainly reported as showing unequivocal improvements in survival and reduction in heart attacks from lowering cholesterol. So in that case, the use of what's called the surrogate endpoint, cholesterol rather than survival, looks like it was a correct and extremely important decision, one that saved many lives by having those drugs available. It would have been very hard for the agency to take the position that no agents that lower cholesterol could be approved until unequivocal evidence of improved survival was available.
And that would have been hard. Wait, let me stop you there. That would have been hard because it would have taken a very long time to prove that?
We didn't even know whether studies big enough to show that could even be done. We know that now because much larger studies have been carried out. It would have been difficult because you can't always base decisions on all the evidence you'd like. One of the things that I don't think Tom understands is that the decision to do something and the decision not to do something are both decisions. what he seems to think is that the only decision that matters is the decision to do something. That is, when you approve, when you that is that you should never do anything ever until you know. Now, our rules unequivocally require that companies prove what they say in the label. That is, they prove that the drug lowers cholesterol. They also require that there be good reason to think that whatever they do is meaningful. But we have not said that you always have to have, for example, the mortality data in hand. And I think the answer is that when there's overwhelming epidemiologic and experimental support for something like the ability to lower, of drugs to lower cholesterol, there would be a certain arrogance in insisting that we have to have mortality data before anybody in this country can treat a high cholesterol. That would be, that would be a remarkable thing to require. And what I think is important is you can lose by saying yes or by saying no.
What would you say to people who are taking drugs for irregular heartbeats now, the drugs in question that were discussed by Thomas More in his book?
Well, as every show on this and as More says, don't do anything without talking to your doctor. I mean, that's quite clear. If a person who has an abnormal rhythm that represents the approved uses, that is, the uses that are in the approved labeling, may want to talk to the physician about it, but we're convinced that those approved uses ought to be are valid and ought to be approved. It's a good idea, I would say, for patients and physicians to know when they're going beyond what the labeled uses say. That doesn't mean they shouldn't ever do it, but they ought to be conscious of the fact that the company has not been able to persuade us yet that such a use is valid, and that there may be reasons to think about it.
What's the lesson of the story for the FDA? Looking back, do you think you did something wrong? What would you do different?
Well, no, I don't think we did anything wrong. We didn't approve the use that caused trouble because we were worried about that use. It's a fact, though, that physicians don't always have to share our worries and can use drugs in ways that we haven't approved. I think there's a message to the community, a reminder that before you have the data, you can't be sure what the outcome will be. That's very important. Moore makes that point. We make that point. But that doesn't always tell you what the right thing to do is. Sometimes before the data are in hand, you have to act anyway. You had to treat high blood pressure before we knew that it saved lives, and it was the right thing to do. You had to treat lower cholesterol. It turns out that it was probably good to lower cholesterol before we knew. But it was not good to suppress abnormal beats in people who had a heart attack with flecainide. That was one where people's attempt to do good didn't work out.
Dr. Robert Temple is the director of the FDA's Office of Drug Evaluation. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.